Welcome to BitCast on Podcast One, the video game podcast with the Axeman.
Welcome back to the BitCast. It's me again, the Axeman, also known as Alex. And for the third episode in a row, I'm joined by...
Henry, excuse me.
Yes, Henry the guest. Excuse his presence, but we have a lot to talk about.
We've had Wong episodes for the past two ones, and we're probably going to have another Wong one with this one.
Yeah, we're going to talk about a game that's close to 2 years old now, at least in the North American regions, because we want to, you know, kind of see what we think of this game now that, you know, it's been a few years, the dust has settled, the series has moved on. We're going to talk about Nintendo's Fire Emblem Fates.
All three paths in this case.
Yes. For those who might not know, it's, you know, a Fire Emblem game. It's Nintendo's strategy RPG series. And for their 14th installment, they kind of did the Pokemon thing where they made separate games for different things you can do. It's not exactly the same as how Pokemon handles it, but that's the comparison that gets thrown around a lot.
Well, two separate games, and the third path was a digital download only, but same premise.
Yeah, in Fire Emblem Fates, you make a choice between two warring factions. You make that choice very early on, and from there, it's an entirely different game based on your answer. You'll support one side or the other side. The plot and the gameplay will be different from each other based on your decision, and you even get a third path. You don't get to join Smash Brothers, like in the protagonist's Smash Brothers trailer. That's not an option, unfortunately.
That was the fourth option. You didn't get it here.
No, and it won't turn into Fire Emblem Warriors, either. Before we talk more about Fire Emblem Fates, let's talk about our history with the game and the series as a whole.
Mine's a little weird. I actually watched a Let's Play years ago when I still watched Slim Kirby. He did a Let's Play of Path of Radiance, which got me interested. However, I didn't actually start playing the game until I picked up Shadow Dragon.
Right.
And then Alex and a mutual friend of ours got me interested in Fire Emblem Awakening. I played through that, beat it, loved it. So when Fates was announced, I'm like, all right, I'll take a look at it.
All right. I have kind of a typical story of... Well, that is a creaky chair.
I am so sorry.
I have a more typical story. I was one of the newbies who came in with Awakening because I wanted to see what all the fuss was about, and I liked it. So Fates was announced and stuff, and I thought, oh, okay, I'll give it a shot when it becomes relevant. And eventually, even though I ended up pre-ordering Fire Emblem Fates Birthright, I missed my pre-order because this was around the time GameStop stopped letting me know about my pre-orders, so I was a little late to get the game. Like, people were talking about it. I was like, wait, the game's out now? So I played through Fire Emblem Fates, and I've been on the Fire Emblem train since then. I got Fire Emblem Echoes, Shadows of Valentia, which I talked about in an earlier episode, and I got the mobile game and then stopped playing the mobile game very quickly, and now I'm trying to get Fire Emblem Warriors.
As of this recording, I still have yet to play Echoes.
I think a lot of people are appreciative of that game, thanks to some of the more controversial choices that Fire Emblem Fates did.
We'll get more into those, and it should go without saying that this will probably have some spoilers in it.
Yeah. Informing people is kind of what I like to do when it's just me, but, you know, when it gets more conversational with a guest, spoilers kind of slip out more easily. So there's your spoiler warning in advance. Let's talk about what Fire Emblem Fates does a little bit differently from the usual Fire Emblem based on what we know about it.
First thing is gameplay changes. One of the biggest ones, in my opinion, is the fact that there's no longer a durability system for your weapons. That was a thing up until Awakening, and in fact is going into slight tangent, one of Robin's mechanics in Smash Brothers, but Fates does away with it.
Yeah. Originally, Fire Emblem Gaiden, the second game in the series, had that, and when they turned it into Fire Emblem Echoes, they brought that back. But Fire Emblem Fates was the first one to be internationally released and to have that system, and that was several years after Fire Emblem Gaiden.
And it's, in my personal opinion, it's actually works really well, because in order to keep things balanced, your weapon also determines which of your stats are increased and which ones are decreased.
Yeah, and there's, I believe, a secondary triangle between arrows, tomes, and knives?
Bows, daggers, and tomes have one, yes.
Alright. And they added daggers as a new weapon type in this game, if I'm correct.
Yes, they did. It's one of the few weapons that can either be used in a melee range, which is adjacent, or at range.
It's also kind of interesting that they introduced a few new classes, but they also divided your classes based on the different campaigns and just kind of gave them different coats of paint to more fit the aesthetics of the different kingdoms.
Coming from someone who did do a little bit of digging and who tries to go a little bit more technical with his, there are also slight differences between the two.
Well,
two sets
mean?
Of weapons. Like, for example, again, spoilers, Hoshiden level D katanas happen to be a little bit stronger than Norian variants.
I wonder if that's to contribute to the Hoshiden campaign being the easier one.
It might be, I don't know. However, at C rank, Norian weapons seem to be a little bit stronger. But I do believe the stat debuffs and buffs are a little different as well.
That's interesting. I do know that the healing items, well, not the healing items, but the staffs and rods that cast the heal spells, I do know that they have a wider range in the Hoshiden campaign than the Norian campaign, but as a result, the healing is less potent.
Healing's less potent. Also, I believe they have less uses. Actually, yes, that is true. For example, at D rank, you have your different staffs. Norian staves can only heal one space away, but they have more uses, and they heal more, whereas the Hoshiden ones don't heal as much, and they don't last as long, but they can heal up to two spaces.
Alright. Another big difference from past games is the My Castle system.
This is a huge point in the game, and it is, in my personal opinion, I'm always a fan of this sort of build up your command center sort of game. I'm also a big fan of sandbox games like Minecraft, so anything like that was just awesome for me.
I like My Castle on paper, but I feel like in terms of the story and lore of Fire Emblem, it raises and facilitates a lot of the big questions that they didn't really try to answer.
It's meant to be a separate dimension, so
I know, but when you start throwing in dimensions and time relativity and stuff into that, and it doesn't even fit into the story at all, because the plot is pretty consistently marching from place to place, so what are we all doing lounging in the alternate dimension?
Well, Awakening did that too, but it didn't have the My Castle system. It was never explained why you're just marching from place to place when you can easily just backtrack to the entire first starting area to buy stuff.
Now that's more like they don't draw attention to that though, but early on they introduce My Castle as part of the story in one of the early chapters.
Just after you make the choice, yeah.
Yeah. So they do draw attention to it, and I like it in terms of gameplay, and it's a bit of customization for the player, but it kind of hurts the story with its presence.
It also is the way you connect with other people via Nintendo Network.
We should probably talk about what My Castle is after we've talked about how we feel about it.
You know, that's a good point. My Castle is essentially your base of operations where you can put down different buildings that all have different functions. It's essentially you're building a fort.
Yeah, it's where you can set up the different shops to buy your armor and equipment. Well, not your armor, but you buy weapons here, or you can farm for ingredients to create items, or you can interact with the other characters in minor ways.
It's also where you do your you can do your supports.
Yeah,
which is something that's been in Fire Emblem for a while now.
Yeah, and you can do your arena battling.
Yep, this is also where you would do battles against other players.
Right.
I would like to point out as well that what you have access to in My Castle is based on your path.
You get certain things that are locked to which campaign you're in. If you play the digital campaign, you get access to basically everything.
So, if you're going from pure gameplay, why would you ever play the other two when the third one just gives you everything anyway?
Yeah, it's best for your PvP needs.
Your PvP, or those who are just very, very technically minded?
Or unless you don't have the money and you can only afford, like, Conquest or something.
Yeah, fair enough.
Let's talk about the big point of the game, the premise. So, in a continent with no name, it's strikingly the first Fire Emblem continent not to have a proper name.
Yeah, we don't ever get one, do we?
Yeah. Two nations are at war. You've got Nor, which is a kind of a grim and very glory-seeking pastiche of different European countries all mixed together. And they're the aggressors in an upcoming war with the nation of Hoshido, which is, I can't believe it's not Japan.
Yeah. That's entirely what it is. I would also like to point out that Hoshido's on the eastern side of the continent, Norian's on the west.
Yeah. And for the war, it's kind of, you know, like I said, Nor are the aggressors, but they haven't been able to escalate to full-blown war because there's a spell that kind of prevents too much hostility in Hoshido. You, the player character, who's determined by, you know, the player input, you get to decide their look and their name.
But for sake of conversation, we were going to go by the American original name, which is Corrin.
Yeah, let's just call them Corrin because that's their name in, you know, Super Smash Brothers and Fire Emblem Heroes and Warriors and stuff. It's Corrin. And you know what? Unlike with Robin in Awakening, I never did give Corrin an alternate name, so they're just always Corrin to me.
I did with mine.
Alright, so Corrin is the main character of this adventure. Corrin has a prophetic dream about having to take a side between Nor and Hoshido. You wake up with Corrin in the middle of Nor. They are one of the royal children of Nor, but they're raised in isolation in a fortress all by themselves with just, you know, that's what isolation means, duh. But they also have, you know, a handful of servants, and they've lived a pretty sheltered life.
Okay, this is where we get into some of the gameplay tutorials, as well as meeting the Norian royal siblings, Xander, Leo, Camilla, and Elise, not in any particular order.
Yeah, the game does its job to try to endear you to the Norian characters before making your choice. And since I went with Birthright first, which is siding with Hoshido, that meant that it was just kind of introducing me to the people I would punch in the gut.
That's entirely right. And if you go Conquest, you'd have these people as allies, but we'll get to that later.
Yeah. So, you're in Nor for a while. You meet your father, the king, who is very much a despot and a tyrant.
I would like to point out his name is King Garen, which is one letter away from Ganon.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
a lot of people have made that joke, and they look like they could have been old college friends or something.
I mean, come on. One thing I've never really liked, and this is any game, but Nintendo seems to do it a lot, is that their bad guys are very obviously bad guys.
You know, it could be worse. Garen could have been a floating face with a pair of hands. Nintendo likes to do that, too.
Okay, you have a point.
Well, technically, if we want to get to the Revelation final boss.
We'll get to that later.
Yeah, you meet Garen, you go on missions for Nor's sake, until eventually you get kidnapped and taken to Hoshido.
You get knocked out and then kidnapped.
Well, yeah, but, you know, the bullet points. You go to Hoshido, and you meet the queen, who is actually your biological mother. Surprise!
Yeah, yep. Apparently you were Hoshidan royalty, kidnapped at birth.
Yeah.
And this is where you meet the other four royal siblings of Hoshido. Noticing a theme here? Ryoma, Takumi, Sakura, and Hinoka.
Yeah, again, in no particular order. You get to know the Hoshidan characters a bit more. The game tries to kind of show you a look at Hoshido, and everything seems to be alright. You know, you're finally back to your true home all along, and then there's an attack on the town plaza. The queen dies, and the barrier that prevents hostilities goes down, so now it's prime time for Nor to invade Hoshido. And the Hoshidans are really worked up because, you know, their queen and mother just died. So you have to make a choice, because by now you remember all the bad stuff Garen did to you by kidnapping you, but you still have your memories of the pleasant days in Nor, so now it's up to Corrin to decide. Do they want to stick with their birth family and get justice, or do they want to stick with their adoptive family of choice and get to the bottom of why things are the way they are? Or maybe they won't even pick a side at all and just want everyone to cool out.
Or they go into Smash. That's not an option.
Yeah. So that's the big selling point of the game, is choosing which family you'd side with, which army you'd side with.
By and large, I feel that the choice is interesting, but not very well executed. Alex and I have discussed this at length, but frankly, the fact that they did it like this, it really just doesn't work, especially with Revelations.
The game has seen a lot of controversy since release over the different story decisions they made, and it didn't help that the localization was not one of the better ones. They took a lot of liberties when they probably shouldn't have.
I would also like to point out that all three paths were written by one guy who is known for writing manga.
I don't actually know much about that part.
He's actually a very popular manga and anime writer in Japan. They hired him to write all three paths.
They kind of didn't monitor him very well, if I recall correctly, what little I do know of the situation.
So they kind of just gave him a pass to do whatever he needed, and honestly, if it had just been Birthright and Conquest, it would be fine.
Yeah, Revelation is kind of having your cake and eating it too, but before we get to Revelation, let's talk a little more about Birthright and Conquest.
Birthright, if you've played Fire Emblem Awakening, is essentially Awakening 2.0. It follows the same format, free grinding, free ways to get gold, things of that nature. It's the easier of the two paths.
That's when you side with the Hoshiden family, and it's just straightforward, hey, let's go get Garen, let's go beat him up.
You are, in the case of the story, you're defending Hoshido, and the best way to take out an invading army is to kill the head.
Yeah, and, you know, Hoshido is your birthright, so hence the title.
There it is. It's, again, easier the two. A lot of the maps are somewhat uninspired, especially during the second half.
Yeah, and because of the fact that you're turning against the country that raised you for most of your life, that means that you're going to have to go up against the siblings that were warm to you in the opening scenes.
Because let's keep in mind here, for story perspective, it's Garen who's the aggressor. The actual siblings of Nor are really actually decent people.
Yeah, like, for as black and white as people like to criticize the game for being, they do a good job, I think, of demonstrating that, you know, Norian soldiers aren't just monsters, with exception of a few mid-bosses.
And the Faceless.
Yeah, well, those are literally monsters.
Okay, fair enough. But yeah, it's very straightforward. The story, in my personal opinion, the Birthright story is simple, but it doesn't need to be complex.
It's easily considered to be the least messed up story, but it's also considered to be the most boring story.
If only because it's let's go defend our homeland story. It's been seen time and time again, not just in fiction, but in war.
Yeah, like, ooh, get the evil emperor. Okay, good job. And one thing is that a lot of people criticize the choice for being too black and white, like I mentioned before. Like, Hoshido is, oh, it's so peaceful and great. Everything is good in Hoshido. Well, Nor is just like, if you've seen some of the concept art of Nor, it's like literally a wasteland in some places. It's like, choice, huh? I wonder who the good guys are.
Yeah, the game does not try to hide the fact.
I mean, I think it's a little better than people would let on, and I find it interesting that the next game they released was Fire Emblem Echoes, which has a similar concept, but a lot more fleshed out.
I will definitely be taking a look at that game later.
Yeah, I'll tell you more about it after this. But Fire Emblem Birthright, it was the first route that I picked because, you know, I know my limits. I didn't want to play Conquest, the hard version, so I played Birthright. And it was kind of interesting. I ended up playing the games in order of difficulty. I'm kind of loyal to the Birthright. The Birthright route. That was a tongue twister waiting to happen.
Yes, it was.
But I'm kind of loyal to that one since that was my first one, and I feel like it has the most emotionally powerful story, or at least the most potential for an emotionally powerful story.
I'm in agreement with that, and Birthright was also my first route. If only because I had just come off Awakening.
Yeah. So, Conquest. Now, a lot of people have very divided views on Conquest. It's considered to have the best gameplay of the three, but also the worst story by far.
The gameplay of Conquest, which is when you side with Nor, is that it's more resemblant of the original Fire Emblem games. No free grinding. You can only do very limited leveling up. That sort of thing.
Yeah, that they're not going to hold your hand as much for Fire Emblem Fates Conquest.
But the story, from what I understand, because I never actually finished Conquest, is a little bit more intricate.
That's one way to put it. You side with Nor, and that puts you up against the Hoshidans, so you're pretty much the evil side of the war, because you're kind of being forced to commit atrocities.
But at the same time, the reason Korin made the choice is because they're trying to find out what happened to Garen, because there's hints throughout the entire game that something happened to him to change him.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I'll say is a point in Revelation's favor, but more on that later. In Conquest, Korin is tasked with doing objectively horrible things, but they use loopholes to try to get around it and avoid committing atrocities, try to end the war with handshakes rather than chopping off hands.
I actually am a veteran of U.S. military, and as we said there, win the hearts and minds of the people, and that's kind of what they're trying to do here.
Yeah, like Korin wants people to get along with each other. They don't want this war between the two nations. So one of their first tasks is to go to a tribe with relative autonomy and try to put them all under. So instead, Korin just wins them over, and they agree to behave themselves so Korin can work on reforming Nor from the inside.
It's definitely a lot more intricate than Birthright, but a lot of people say it's the worst story, and I'll just have to take their word on it, I suppose, because I never finished it.
I can get into that, because I did kind of expose you to more parts of the story.
Oh, fair enough.
That as it goes on, it gets harder and harder for Korin to have wiggle room to get out of committing crimes. So those heartless mid-bosses that I described, they're on your side this time, but they're gonna just go ahead and make things harder for you.
There are a couple of specific characters that come to mind immediately with this.
I think we're thinking the same thing, but you do eventually get to deal with the ramifications of doing bad things, and Korin does not get loopholes. Like, one of the middle to later chapters involves visiting the village of the Kitsunes, and they're completely nice and agreeable, but they attack you because you walked into their home, and they can't afford to let anyone into their home, and you have to kill them all. There's no choice. You have to kill all the Kitsunes. And it's just one of the low points in terms of morality, because someone had to suffer after all. Korin can't just get out of this with completely clean hands.
And that's something I really do like, is that one actually shows, hey, Korin, you know, life will not throw you a bone.
Yeah, because for the first few chapters, Korin gets their loopholes, but eventually it comes back to get them.
Right. So, now for the elephant.
Yeah, the plot of Conquest. The part where a lot of people think that it really takes a nosedive. I don't know if that's what you were talking about, but it was a good segue that I thought it bears mentioning.
Okay.
About middle of the way through Conquest, you figure out that Garen is actually impersonated by a monster, a hideous monster. And the only way to get rid of him, because, you know, that's the reason why Garen is such a tyrant, the only way to get rid of him is to have him sit on the Hoshidan Queen's throne, which has magical properties that's been established, and it'll reveal his true form. So how are you going to get him to sit on the Queen's throne? Well, time to conquer Hoshido.
Well,
we only have to win a war.
That's the conquest side of it.
Yeah, you're conquering Hoshido. And it feels like, well, I get it, because, you know, that is a way to get his true form on display for everyone to see. But it's just so convoluted, and like there's a lot of things that have to go right for that plan to work.
I'd like to point out that going back to Birthright, again, we said spoilers at the beginning of this, Garen is your final boss in Birthright, and he actually does transform in that.
Yeah, his transformation's a little different. I feel like that's one of the points of inconsistency, because it is.
Yeah.
But you have to conquer Hoshido, and, you know, a lot of people have to die.
You only have to take over a nation. I mean, it's not that big a deal, right?
Yeah, welcome to hard mode.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and there's a lot of unnecessary secrecy in the plan. Like, Korin and the other principal character, Azura, one of the characters who joins you no matter which side you take, the two of you are the ones who come up with the plan to have Garen sit on that throne, and it's not until that happens that you tell your family about this or the other soldiers about this. They're just going off faith that you know what you're doing, and that's very flimsy.
Especially considering Korin is actually supposed to be, as far as age, the fifth one in the middle. So she technically should be deferring to Xander,
who's the eldest. Or he.
Or he, I'm sorry.
Yeah, because Korin, like, I believe the female form is more popular, so a lot of people interpret that as Korin. But more importantly, I think the thing with Korin is that Garen specifically assigned Korin to take the lead on the operation.
So oh, okay.
In Birthright, it makes no sense, but there's a bit of justification in Conquest.
In Birthright, though, yeah, you're right, because technically, in that case, Ryoma's the eldest. He should be the one leading.
Yeah.
But if Garen said, hey, you're in charge, then that makes sense.
Yeah.
Although, again, once they get him on the throne and do expose his true form, who is not the final boss, by the way, that would still make all of his claims illegitimate anyway.
Well, yeah, but at the time, they...
Oh, yeah,
they kind of had to go along with it, and by the time they get to the final sequences, it's clear that Korin knows a bit more about the situation anyway than Xander.
Okay, that's fair.
So, Conquest was messy. There's no denying it. I think it's a little better than people give it credit for. In fact, the one that I think deserves a little more flack is the middle route, Revelation.
That's what I was saying the elephant in the room about, actually, was Revelation. Oh, God. The spoilers are going to be heavy, and... let's just get started with this.
Well, Fire Emblem Fates Revelation is considered kind of the golden true path of the game. It avoids hurting either side by having Korin take the middle ground, and eventually they manage to win the hearts and minds of people from both sides, including all 8 sibling characters...
Again, as we stated earlier, if you're going to do it purely for gameplay, play Revelation simply because you have access to both sides.
Right. And the thing is that Revelation goes into more of the lore of the game and why certain characters are the way they are,
and it
namely
is,
Garen.
And it is messy.
You feel stronger about this than I do, I think.
It's because it... retcons so much that was established in the other two paths needlessly.
Yeah, I do feel like it kind of bends over backwards a few times too many.
Like, you said it earlier, is it's trying to have your cake and eat it too. Let's just get to the spoiler part of it. There's a hidden third kingdom underground called Vala.
Yeah, and for very plot-convenient reasons, you're not allowed to talk about Vala unless you're inside Vala, and it's, you know, in another dimension.
Is it ever established as in another dimension?
Well, I mean,
it might as well be.
It looks right. Like another dimension if you have to hop through a canyon to get there, and or, it's floating.
Or you have to go through a lake, like Azura likes to do.
Yeah, so it's in another world, basically.
Oh, and by the way, if you mention Vala outside of Vala, you just apparently wither away into nothing.
Yeah, that's the convenient curse. And it's kind of silly when you think about it.
I get why they did it. It's to prevent, you know, any of this from coming to light, even though, you know, just better foreshadowing in Birthright or Conquest would have helped a lot.
Yeah, well, it's kind of funny what they did with their foreshadowing is that Revelation goes into a bit more of Azura's backstory. Not a whole lot, but it does, and it also goes into Garen's backstory. What they do with Birthright and Conquest is that Birthright focuses more on foreshadowing Azura, while Conquest foreshadows Garen a bit more.
So, if you're going to come at this from story perspective, you want to play Birthright and Conquest first,
yeah.
Then play Revelation.
Yeah. It does defeat the purpose of a choice if this one is, like, the obviously correct path.
Just don't side with either one, yeah. That's not what really bugs me about it. I understand giving them the third option. From a purely gameplay perspective, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I get that.
But the biggest thing is Corrin's retconning.
Hmm. That was a part that didn't sit right with me either, but before we get into that, I want to talk about map design.
Ah, yes, because we didn't go into it with Conquest.
Yeah, is that Conquest, for the first half, reuses different maps from Birthright, and did I say Conquest reuses? I meant Revelation uses it. It reuses maps from the other two games throughout the first half, which I don't mind, but it's a little, you know, creatively lacking, and it's more focused on gimmicks than anything else. It's not quite to the highlights that Conquest's map design reached.
Because Conquest's map design was actually really creative.
Yeah, and the different situations and limitations imposed on you.
Not just from the fact that you can't freely grind like you can in Birthright.
Yeah, and in Revelation, it kind of gets really boring with the later maps. Like, they focus more on gimmicks than actual interesting design.
That being said, the second half of the game, when you're actually in Vala, the map design there is a little better.
No, I disagree.
In my opinion.
Okay. So, we disagree about how the second half of the game is designed. Like I said, it keeps the gimmick focus and doesn't really have good design. That's one of the things that really struck out to me.
You got three strikes.
Yeah. One of the things that really stood out to me was that, I believe it was chapter 11, you get the flying unit, Reyna.
Mm-hmm.
Chapter 12, you're all on boats in a frozen ocean, and a lot of the tension comes from the fact that you have to wait for boats to kind of not be frozen in certain places.
That's the one you have to wait for the dragon veins, I believe.
Yeah, but one chapter ago, you just got Reyna, who can fly. You can have her go fight the boss and end the chapter right away.
Yep, and because Revelation is structured more like Birthright, wherein you have the free grinding, you can also just get enough seals to do it yourself as well.
Yeah, that's the big example that I think of when I think of Revelation maps not really being built with the characters in mind. Because the other example is, towards the end of the first half, you get your Norian brothers to join the army, and they bring their sidekicks with them. And you get Odin in there, and his stats are laughable.
Yeah, he's also not even a promoted unit. Most everybody in your army by this point, unless you've just really been neglecting them, should be promoted.
Yeah, but Odin's not. He has early to mid-game stats in the direct middle of the game. He's not going to keep up with everyone.
Nah. I mean, at least the good news here is that you can just leave him in the back and just let everyone else do the work.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean that that's good game balance.
It's not, because they should have really had him stronger for this point.
Yeah, it's really weird. Like, just two chapters prior to this, you get the characters Shura and Nyx in the same chapter. Shura is pre-promoted, but, you know, his level is balanced. Nyx is unpromoted, and she is woefully underleveled. And then she's in the same chapter as Shura. It's like, what are you guys doing? Where's the balance? Are you awake?
Awakening.
That's what they need.
Clearly.
But what were you trying to say about Korn's retconning? I'm sorry.
It's much later, near the end. Remember when we said that Korn's mother was Queen Makoto?
Yeah, she was the Queen of Hoshido.
Was not originally, however.
No.
You find out later, Korin is actually Valite.
Yeah, Korin was actually born in the land of Vala before Makoto had to escape with Korin to the regular plane and ended up in Hoshido. So, what does that mean, Henry?
That means that Birthright is completely pointless. Simply because you don't even have a birthright to Hoshido. You have a birthright to Vala. Oh, and so does Azura, by the way.
It kind of defeats the whole "this is your blood family" purpose that is just in all the advertising. It's like, okay, false advertising now.
At least Conquest, I mean, you know that's your adoptive family. So now, you can still run with that.
Now, the thing is that as much as that plot point rubbed me the wrong way, I can still kind of see through it. It's just like, well, you know what? Makoto wasn't going to go back to Vala anyway. Like, you were going to be in Hoshido if you weren't kidnapped anyway, so it might as well be your birthright, but
I still think that foreshadowing that would have been a lot better.
Well, they did foreshadow it a little bit in both the routes.
Oh, it's been a while since I played, but I completely missed it.
Oh, yeah, they're very brief. Like, in one point in Birthright, one of your brothers from Nor sets a trap that only affects people from Hoshido, but Korin is mysteriously unaffected.
Oh, that's right.
And then there's the fact that in Conquest, Korin is the only one besides Azura who can travel through ponds.
Yeah. Azura is also kind of an interesting point, because, seriously, I get the curse with Vala exists, but she still couldn't have brought, you know, what's actually happening to everyone's attention, because going back to Revelation's plot, everything that's happening between Nor and Hoshido is being orchestrated by Vala.
Yeah, there's a mad dragon that's ruling Vala and trying to destroy both the other kingdoms.
Yep, that would be Nankos, who's also the final boss of Revelation.
And might count as a head and hands boss, depending on how you look at it.
Fair enough.
Because those are the only parts of him you can target.
Oh, wow, that's kind of hilarious. But, yeah, he's actually the final boss of Revelation. He actually gets a lot of backstory in some of the DLC.
Yeah, which also rubbed people the wrong way, because they could have done this in the plot, but they had to hide it behind DLC instead.
The other thing is, and this is another big spoiler, three of the characters in Fire Emblem Fates are actually the kid characters from Awakening.
Yeah, this actually isn't the first time Fire Emblem has recycled characters. I've done a little more research since then.
I mean, it's not the first time, not including direct sequels, I'm assuming.
Well,
Like Path of Radiance to Radiant Dawn.
Well, in Fire Emblem Gaiden, you get the three Pegasus Riding Sisters, and they're explicitly the same characters who helped Marth in the first game.
Oh, okay.
And you get another character who is an amnesiac version of one of the antagonists from that game as well.
See, that's okay, though, because they're explicitly stated to be from a different game. Here, they try to hide it.
Well, if
it's hinted at, but they're from somewhere else, but
they try to hide it until you hear their support conversations with each other. And in the DLC, they make it very clear that, yes, it's the ones from Awakening.
Mm-hmm. By the way, did we mention Awakening is a separate dimension to Fates? That's one of the DLCs.
Yeah, that's kind of weird. Or it's time travel. No one's really sure.
I'm fairly... It's pretty much a separate dimension, because Crom actually mentions it in the Before Awakening DLC. He's heard of the Hoshido and Nor.
All right.
Even though they don't exist in the same plane.
Now, going back to that Gaiden example, I don't know how popular the Pegasus Riders were in the original game. I don't know how popular that antagonist was to make them all playable in Gaiden and Echoes. But the returning characters in Fates from Awakening, it's very clearly because they were popular.
Yeah, that makes sense. They were the most popular child characters, or their parent characters were really popular as well. Which Awakening had time travel, so it was kind of justified with the whole kid thing.
Before we open that can of worms...
Yeah, okay.
I'd like to point out that the kid characters introduced in this game, who are based on returning characters, are all based on adult characters from Awakening, like Gaius and Cordelia and stuff.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
So they were brought in as kind of the opposite generation, because now the kids from the past game are adults in this one now.
Oh, yeah, fair enough.
But again, the common thread is that they were popular Awakening characters in Japan. It was clearly pandering.
Oh, of course. Fan service isn't by itself inherently bad, but it has to be executed correctly.
Yeah, and the way the whole kid system worked out, it was not handled tastefully. Well, okay, like Odin, Laszlo, and Selena, they work, I think, because they're not too distracting. It's the kids, like Asugi, Raja, and Keldori. Those are the ones that are kind of, well, this is just pandering.
To put it in perspective for those who don't know, Awakening's parent-child system was because that game had time travel, so the adult versions of those kids were traveling back in time to prevent an apocalyptic future.
Yeah, very DBZ kind of thing.
Yeah, that at least makes sense to me. Fates, you get the child characters because they're in a different dimension.
Yeah, so going back to the DBZ comparison, it's like the hyperbolic time chamber, where time passes differently. Your characters just kind of have their baby in a pocket dimension, And the next time you see them, they're all grown up because time passed differently, and now they're of convenient army fighting age to join your party. And I don't think anyone has said anything good about how that was handled.
If there's one good thing about it, the child characters in Fates are better balanced than the ones in Awakening.
I'll have to take your word for that.
The ones in Awakening could get so powerful you never needed to use the parents again except for Crom.
Alright.
Crom and Robin, but...
I like the characters in and of themselves. Like, Jacob's son, Dwyer, is one of my favorite characters in the game, but no one I know of actually likes the justification for the child characters.
They shouldn't have been in Fates at all, really.
Yeah, it was very clearly, hey, Awakening had that, let's do it again.
Yeah, except Awakening's justification worked with its lore and its plot.
Yeah, see, the thing with Fates that I've said at length is that it tried to do too many things. It tried to have a morally complex story. It tried to have your town simulator. It tried to be a little more visual novel, love story inspired. It tried to top Awakening. It tried to surpass Awakening. It tried to ignore Awakening. It just tried to do everything and then did half of everything.
Essentially, it was trying to do so much that it ended up not doing enough in any one of those things.
Yeah.
Although, again, I like the town simulator aspect, but...
Yeah, I mean, it had good ideas. I'll always say this. It had good ideas. I like the characters, but the way that everything was handled was not the greatest.
Yeah. Speaking of not handled, Lost in Thoughts All Alone.
All right, I'll pretend that was a segue. So, let's get to that. Lost in Thoughts All Alone, the signature song of Fire Emblem Fates. The Japanese singer, her name escapes me right now, but in English it was sung by Rena Strober, who provides the voice for Azura. And, you know, I've heard her as Azura in other things, and, you know, I've heard her sing other things. She's a very talented singer and actress.
And I don't doubt that Lost in Thoughts is actually a decent song on its own.
Yes, it's very good.
In fact, it gets remixed into one of my favorite songs from the game, which we'll get to later. But it is overused.
Yeah, Lost in Thoughts All Alone, the lyrics are very tailored to the premise of the game, of having to choose between the different sides and what the sides are presented as. Now, the thing is, another weird part of the song that a lot of people have mercifully glossed over is that the pronunciation is kind of weird, like, emphasis is weird in the song, because they tried to translate it from Japanese without changing the melody at all.
Whereas they really, what they should have done is just made a completely new song in English.
I don't think that would have worked, because so many of the soundtrack songs rely on the melody of Lost in Thoughts.
That's a good point. There's really not a better way to have made it work. It runs eight, because Japanese to English or English to Japanese is really hard to do.
Well, I think they handled it pretty well, actually, in this case.
Like I said, it's a good song on its own, but it's just overused.
Okay, I'll agree with that. Like, despite the weird emphasis in the lyrics, the song came out in English pretty great. But yeah, every song in the soundtrack, or at least 95% of them, has that riff, the do-do-do-do-do-do-do. It has that somewhere in there, in almost every song.
Mm-hmm. Some of the cutscenes get downright insufferable with it.
Yeah, they just... I like to call it Smash Brothers Syndrome, because in Smash Brothers Brawl and the fourth game, all the original songs just contained the same riff without really doing anything with them, but...
Melee did that too.
Yeah, but I think with the presence of Subspace Emissary and Brawl, it kind of drew more attention to it.
But the thing that the Smash Brothers games have is music from other Nintendo games that's completely different.
Yeah, that distracts you from the fact that they're just using the same tune over and over. I just keep switching between different words for music. Like, actual musicians are going to listen to this and just go, ugh.
Yeah, any musicians out there, we are sorry.
Yeah. It's very repetitive, but the song is good.
The one thing I wish... Well, okay, and I say it gets downright insufferable in cutscenes because whenever you hear it in cutscenes, you only ever hear, like, the first lyric, and that's it.
Oh, you mean when Azura actually sings it.
Yeah, you only hear like the first sentence and that's it.
Mm. The song has plot relevance because close to the middle of the first two campaigns, Birthright and Conquest, you get a cinematic of Azura performing in an opera house to try to expel the curse from him. Both times she sings the same song, but she just sings it in different styles. It's kind of weird. I don't really know what they were going for with that, but
it is kind of weird. Oh, we should probably point out that the song is magical.
Well, yeah, but
and also if she uses it too much, it will kill her.
Yeah, that's one of the points of intrigue for Azura that's highlighted a lot in Birthright and then dropped in Revelation.
Well, yeah, because
and only hinted at in Conquest.
Yeah, come on, game, you're inconsistent here.
Yeah, well, I mean, we've talked about, like, almost 50 minutes for how inconsistent the game has been. We could do it a little more, but, you know, like I said, the game came out, like, 2 or 3 years ago. I think it's a dead horse. This is kind of meant to be more of a retrospective.
I suppose, and I won't deny, I had my fun with the game. I really, if there's one thing I have to say about all three paths, is I like the gameplay changes. I like not having to worry about durability. I like the seals, which came back from Awakening, but they balanced them here to where you couldn't just keep using the same seal over and over. You actually have to switch if you want to keep leveling up.
Now, the seal, for people who don't know, that's what allows you to change your character's classes, right?
Yes.
All right.
You can't, unlike Awakening, if you switch classes in Awakening, you start back at level 1.
Yeah.
Here, you don't do that anymore, unless you go from a base class to a promoted one.
All right.
Because at that point, they retains the same level.
I remember when I played Conquest, I had a lot of fun despite the challenge to it. It felt like fair challenge.
It's and it is pretty fair. I mean, the enemies, depending on what level you play as, are either going to be not hard, difficult enough, or oh lord, I'm going to die.
Awakening was good. It didn't leave as much of an impact as Fates did, for better or worse. Fates was kind of a focal point for me for the better part of a year and a half after playing it. And I did actually describe it as within my top 5 favorite games. I don't know if I still feel that way now, but it was a very, very memorable experience. And yeah, I'm glad I played it.
And for better or worse, we've nitpicked, we've griped, but we enjoy the game. We just felt that there was a lot of wasted potential.
It's like I said, Fire Emblem Echoes seems to be kind of trying to capitalize more on some of the different ideas that Fates had, kind of try to do some of those ideas justice. I don't know if I'd say I like Echoes more than Fates, because I feel like Fates is more accessible. Because like I said, I'm kind of a weenie at playing games. I don't go for the mega hard challenges. I actually hate doing mega hard challenges.
That's more of my forte.
Yeah, like, I'll do it, like, once and then die, like, 10 times and be like, okay, I get the idea.
As for me, I'm the one who smashes his head against the brick wall, but
now that we've talked about the game at length, let's leave it on another positive note. Let's talk about today's favorite songs. Henry, would you like to go first?
I mentioned this earlier, Lost in Thoughts gets remixed into probably my favorite song in the entire game, End of All, and there's 3 different versions of it.
Right, that's the final map theme, no matter which route you are on, and the lyrics of the middle verse are the only ones that change based on which version you're at.
Right, it depends on which one, and it does reference what campaign you've been playing. The one that's most intriguing is actually the Revelation change. That's End of All Below.
Yeah, the different versions based on the campaigns. End of All Sky version is for Birthright, Land version is for Conquest, and Below version is Revelation.
Both Sky and Land have the Lost in Thoughts All Alone line,
yeah,
which is not present in the Revelation version.
Right, the lyrics are a little different for that verse. Another song you liked?
This one is a DLC song, actually. Mm-hmm. It's called Contest of Pride.
Right, this plays in the DLC maps that relate to all the royal characters and the retainers teaming up, or the DLCs that pertain to the bonus classes.
Like the Ballistician or the Witch.
Right.
I
Actually, I can't really tell you what I like about this song. I think it's just the fact that it's kind of got a unique feel to it, but it still feels like an actual... It's not really a triumphant theme, but at the same time, it's not a dark one either.
It's got a good amount of tension. I don't remember. Is this one of the few songs where Lost in Thoughts doesn't make a cameo?
I believe so, yes.
Maybe that has to do with it.
Probably.
And another song?
The final one is actually one from... It plays in both Conquest and Birthright, I believe. It's called No Justice.
Yeah, it actually plays in like all the routes, I think, because certain maps use that theme. Like they're not too picky about which music appears in which route.
By the way, for Contest of Pride and No Justice, these are the field versions, not the battle versions.
Right, that's an important distinction, because in this game and in Awakening, the battle music is just the same as the map music, but with like extra instruments added and stuff.
No Justice is the fact that it's very subdued.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have a whole lot of big bombastic music unless you're listening to the battle version. But the field version is just very... It's almost like you're going through a shady town at dusk.
Well, that's kind of where it does play a lot of the times.
Well, there you go, then.
It reminds me of Windy Mountains.
Yeah, I can see that.
I'm not actually as much a fan of that song as a lot of the other ones, but I do like the combat version of it. I like the march of the bagpipes.
Yeah, the fact that they use bagpipes in this is actually pretty impressive.
Yeah, it kind of is another example of the soundtrack really trying to sell you on Noor versus Hoshido, because they'll use instruments appropriate to the different cultural pastiches.
Right, No Justice is Noorian, thus it'll use more European stuff, bagpipes from Scotland, that sort of thing.
Yeah. So, for my favorite songs, probably my favorite song in the whole game, actually, is A Light Storm version. It is the battle version of some of the last few stages in the Birthright route. It's when you're, pretty much at Garen's castle and going through the last of his henchmen before you finally get to Garen himself. It's exciting, like you're almost there, and the Hoshiden sound with the Japanese instruments just kind of adds to it, like reminding you of who you're with, who you're fighting beside.
I'd like to point out that that does play during that scene, unless you're fighting the royals, I believe? The siblings.
Oh, yeah, like, the siblings get their own boss theme, and the Xander map has its own music, which I'll talk about in a moment. Another song I like is the combat version of Past Below. It's the Past Below flow version. It plays for one map in Conquest when you visit Vala briefly, and then it's the combat music for half of the Vala maps in Revelation.
So I kind of got a little sick of it by the end of it, but I can see why you would enjoy it.
Yeah, it just kind of reminds me of the fact that, we're on a new playing field now. We're off the rails. Anything could happen here.
And considering some of the wonky physics in Vala, that's not entirely wrong.
The last favorite song is Thorn in You, which is a really somber, melancholic, just a sad song. It plays right after you make your choice, and you have to fight the family that you just betrayed.
Or both, in the case of Revelation.
Actually, it's weird. In Revelation,
Well, you don't fight them directly, but you fight their armies.
Yeah, and it's not really a sad scene. At least I didn't read it as one, so I feel like it was misplayed there. But in Birthright and Conquest, they play when you go up against the elder brother of each family, and it's tragic because you have to kill them no matter what. Like, you can't get out of it. It's like the final test before going up against Garen in either side.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like the Xander map kind of deserves it more for plot reasons than the Ryoma one does, but I still feel like it's a powerful song. The combat version of it is also good.
One thing we didn't mention real quick, the supports in Revelation can just get downright hilarious at times.
It's actually kind of funny to see the characters from the different campaigns, how they would react to each other.
In a setting where they're not trying to kill each other.
Yeah, it's kind of good. Like, what I like about Fire Emblem Fates, to say one more thing about it, is that you see a lot of different characters at their best and their worst, and I really like that.
And a lot of them are not one-note characters anymore.
Which has kind of been a Fire Emblem staple for a long time.
Some people would argue that, but I think there are definitely good characters in Fire Emblem Fates. I like the characters a lot.
I agreed.
So, that was it for the podcast. These are just getting longer and longer. Henry, would you like to plug anything?
I need to go plug in my toaster.
All right. I have been the Axeman, also known as Alex, and that was Henry. If you like listening to the BitCast, please consider subscribing so you can hear more in the future. And I might even try to have other guests. I might try to bring Henry back. Who knows what'll happen? I'll see you in the next one.
Listen to BitCast anytime on podcast1.com and on the Podcast One app.
The South Dakota Stories, Volume 7. My trip to South Dakota was the best summer ever. Now I don't need to go to Mars, because I've been to the Badlands. And I caught a bigger walleye than Dad when we went to the Missouri River. Then I rode my bike through these huge rocks called needles. Ooh, I also saw my first herd of bison, even a fuzzy furry baby one. I can't wait to go back and see more. There's so much South Dakota, so little time.